Welcome to Running for Real, a global community with a shared love and curiosity for running. Together we reconnect with the reasons why we love to run and discover ways it helps us become better people. Whether it's the quiet moments of a morning run while the rest of the world still sleeps, or befriending the strangers next to you at the start line of a race, we are here to connect with others who see running as the common thread that weaves our lives together. Come join me, Tina Muir, as I talk with people from all walks of life, united by a love of running. Hello, my friends. Welcome to episode 299. We're almost there. 299 of the Running for Real podcast. Thank you for joining me today. I'm excited that you are here. And this is an episode that I felt like myself and the guests were just like on fire together. We were having such an engaging and interesting conversation about many of the topics that you have asked me about over the years, that you have wanted to know about, that I've had emails, hundreds of thousands of emails about. Many of these topics, I've never heard someone describe them in such a clear and comprehensive way. I really am excited to share this episode with you because I think it's going to be very hard hitting. So today I am excited to welcome Steve Magnus back on the show. Steve has been on in the past in January 2019. It was a really big conversation back then, a very important one, as you will hear just a little bit about that at the beginning. And his new book, I just was like bowled over by a lot of the concepts in it. And I'm not going to, in any more of it, I'm not going to spoil it. So let's go meet Steve Magnus, who is the former University of Houston cross country coach. He coaches elite athletes all over the world. You may know his newsletter, The Growth Equation, which he writes with Brad Stuhlberg. He is also the author of two books with Brad Stuhlberg, who was also a previous guest on the show here. Peak Performance, which you may have heard of, The Passion Paradox, was one that I really loved. And they're always very thoughtful and introspective. So on that note, let's go chat to Steve Magnus. Thank you to Inside Tracker for sponsoring this episode of the Running for Real podcast and for supporting me in my journey towards health. Now, I have told you before, I totally geek out over getting my Inside Tracker results. I hate needles. I don't think I can quite explain just how much I get scared. I nearly pass out every time. Yeah, I still love getting my Inside Tracker test done. I'm actually looking at my results page right now and I've had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 Inside Tracker tests done. And I love to see them. And it is really cool to just watch how things change over time. Now, that said, I'm looking at this right now. I'm looking at my results and I see that I have 7 things that need work. So you can either get at risk, needs work, or optimize. So I am thankful that most of mine are optimized, but I do have 7 that need work. Now, if I look at the first one I see here is lipid group. So lipid group, it tells me I'm in the need work section. It gives me healthy foods to help with my lipid group. So for this, it is Hubbard squash, chia seeds, avocado, acorn squash, raspberries. Those are obviously tailored to whatever lifestyle factors, diet factors you have. I am a vegetarian, therefore that changes my answers. It also gives you a bit more information as to what lipid group or whatever it is actually means, and tells you ways to change it. You can also read the blog about it. You can watch a video about it if you are interested. And it just allows you to compare over time as you can see your results and how they change. Now, I have been using Inside Tracker for many years. I cannot recommend it enough. And if you are feeling off, if something feels off and you can't figure it out, this is the way to do it. And even better than that, you can now upload your own results. If you do have blood work from your doctor, you can upload your results. They will give you those recommendations. They will allow you to check in. It really is a fantastic service. So friends, as a Running For Real listener, you can get 20% off by going to insidetracker.com/Tina. That's insidetracker.com/Tina to go get yourself 20% off. Come join me and geek out over these numbers. Steve, welcome back to the Running For Real podcast. I am excited to have you back on, although this time we're doing it via video chat. Last time was in person, so we've kind of gone the wrong direction, but It is what it is.
Well, I'm glad to be back on. I wish we were in person again, but this will have to do. So let's do it.
We're not trying to sit. I think we were sitting in like a like a curtained off part of a restaurant. It wasn't really quiet, but we did the best we could. So it was a random impromptu chat. But I am excited to have you on today. Now, I didn't tell you this before we started recording. Two things. One, I don't think I had done this before your last one. But when I am going to interview someone who has a book coming out, I'm not going to give you the like PR. I mean, you probably wouldn't expect any different with me at this point, but I'm not going to give you the PR questions. I read this and there's stars all over it. And I have a lot of questions, but I have to confess, in true authentic Tina sense, you will see I'm holding up my book and I didn't make it all the way through. So as much as I wanted to, I just didn't get a chance to finish it. So if there's anything in the the final third that I missed that you think is an important point, I want to make sure we save some room for that at the end. That said, your new book, Do Hard Things, Why We Get Resilience Wrong and the Surprising Science of Real Toughness, completely exploded my mind because I feel like it's exactly the path of what I've been following over the last 5 years since I left the professional running world. And it was, I'd always felt this and I'd always spoken about it publicly, but it always felt like recreational runners that I spoke to were like, well, duh. And like, of course, when you like push yourself to the brink every day and like put all this pressure on yourself, you're not gonna enjoy it. And you're not gonna like feel good about it. Like, that's obvious, isn't it? But I didn't realize it. I'm sure you're the same. And many people who are competitive find it hard to untangle what toughness means. So we're going to go into that. But first, I have to ask about the topic. Last time you came on, we were talking in a slightly careful manner about some of the stuff that you were about to publicly say, but you couldn't quite say about the whole Alberto Salazar, Nike explosion of things. Now, I don't want to go into that today. This is not about that. But I am curious if your experience of like the trauma you must have been through over the last few years with these court cases and things you have to do, and just the way I'm sure you've been hit in many ways that the public may never know about. I don't want you to explain that. Is that where you really started to explore this, or has this been something you've always been curious about?
That's a very good and deep question.
And very long-winded, so
yes,
sorry.
But no, I'm glad you asked that, because no one so far has asked the connection to that experience. And I kind of surprised by that, because when you write books to help others, but you actually often write books to help yourself, which is, what are the things that are like so deeply ingrained in me that I'm struggling and wrestling with that I don't quite have figured out fully? And the book kind of provides the avenue for me to wrestle with, figure that thing out. Mm-hmm. And the honest truth is, this book's genesis, the idea, the outline, the research all began as I was still going through the Salazar Nike stuff. And a lot of that comes from, I thought I knew how to get through tough times because, you know, like yourself, I'm like, I've run at a high level. Like, this is what we do. We just kind of put our head down and get through challenging times and everything will be okay. But I remember specifically one of the first times I had to go into essentially, we'll call it a court case, arbitration, whatever you want to call it, for this whole thing. I mean, I was more panicked and freaked out than at any point in my life. Mm-hmm. I remember it like, I always thought I knew what a panic attack felt like, but I didn't know until I got into that moment. And it was just completely just threw me for a loop, because I was just like, my brain doesn't work. Like, my body is shutting down. Mm-hmm. Like, my instinct is to like get up, run out the door, and just escape. And I never experienced something to that degree. So the long-winded answer is yes, absolutely. Like this book, although I don't talk about it in the book, which is very intentional, and I haven't been asked this, but I'll explain it. Because the Salazar case took 10 years of my life, essentially. Yes. From 2012, when I blew the whistle, I mean, I experienced it for years, for the 2 years before, but from when I blew the whistle in 2012, the case did not end fully until 2021. So it's 9 years essentially from blowing the whistle till to ending. And I felt like it had been such my part. It's such a part of my story that I don't want to tell it unless I'm ready to fully.
Absolutely.
And in this book, I'm not ready to. This book wasn't about the Salazar case, although it was my internal struggle with it that prompted it. It was about something much bigger, which is regardless of what you're facing, like how do we navigate challenges? How do we make ourselves, you know, resilient and get on the other side of that difficult thing to do?
Yes, yes. And that came across so clearly. I mean, I remember reading that you were saying that we try to build toughness through callousness. And we're trained to respond to fear and power, I think you said. I mean, that case, that situation is surely the biggest example of that. You've got one of the most powerful companies in the world. And you, I'm guessing, learned that your methods you've been using in your running of like, yeah, like grip my head down and I'll just like through it. Like that doesn't work. And as you said, 10 years of your life, that you can only take so much of that like tension before you're going to have a stomach ulcer or something else. So I would imagine a lot of it was untangling that. And I really admire and respect you for saying that, you know, I'm not ready to process this and you probably won't be for many years to come. So I respect you for actually letting it ride all the way through rather than rushing something out for the sake of it. One thing I want to mention before we go any further, which is really funny. So I wrote back in the blogging days, I think it was like 2014 or 15, I wrote two blog posts on my website. One was called How to Handle Physical Freakouts and one was called How to Handle Mental Freakouts. And I had, this is kind of what I had called them, like in terms of, I used the marathon as an example, like a physical freakout was when like, I would remember at mile like 15, I'd feel like almost like a wave of like, almost like a tingling, like like warning, like back off. But then a mental freak out was where I would, you know, be like, I can't do this. I'm going to have to walk. Like spiral out of control. And so I loved reading that you took it the same. So, you know, I loved reading about it in detail. And also even beyond that, like some of the things you talked about are things that are never like have not been mentioned to this point. And I just could never understand why no one else thought about this stuff. So I'm really excited to dig into this because you and I have a lot in common there and a lot to dig into. So yeah, thanks for giving me someone who understands me. okay. So toughness. I just said about we tried to train it through callousness. One thing I want to begin with is that you talk about how important it is that it isn't that we can handle toughness or we can't, but we need to be taught the skills of how to handle things that go wrong. So talk about that part of like where are we going wrong right now in terms of what we're taught by society versus learning those tools to actually handle it.
Yeah, I think societally what happens is we just kind of infer that either like you have it or you don't.
Yes.
Right? And it's almost like this magic genetic quality that some people are gifted. And you can tell in the way we talk about people, right? Mm-hmm. We talk about individuals and say, oh, that person's tough or that person's like a clutch performer. And it's we're labeling the individual instead of thinking of it as like, oh, No, this is just like a state that they can occupy for a moment. Like everybody has that capacity to be resilient, tough, like come through in the clutch, et cetera, handle difficult things. And I think that does us a big disservice, because when we identify it as a label that you either have or don't, then it's not something that we can develop. But if you look at the research and the high performers, it actually is something that you can develop. And actually, Tina, I'll give you a behind the scenes thing on it. We'll say it's exclusive to this podcast because I haven't talked about it before. But about eight or nine years ago, I took and I surveyed all the elite professional athletes I was working with on like all these validated measures of like grit and toughness and all this stuff. And you would be shocked, because some of these like world-class performers scored very low on these markers. Okay. And then years later, I ran the same thing, right? And then some of these same elite performers who scored really low, now they scored really high. Well, if you look at, you correlated them with like where their performance was, it was because they were going through a bad patch when they scored low. And they just thought, oh, I must not be that like tough or what have you.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh. So it's like this attribute that changes even among the best of the best. And I think if you look at whether it's athletics, you look at parenting, you look at teaching, leading, is when we see it as a skill that can be developed, that's better off for all of us. Mm-hmm. So it's something that if you're sitting there saying like, oh, I'm so like, I can't handle pain or discomfort or whatever have you, that's all in your head, right? Like you have the capacity, but like anything, you have to train that capacity. You have to teach yourself up. You have to sit with discomfort and learn the skills to learn how to navigate things. And if you learn those skills, you're going to get better at it.
You just answered what I was going to have you say next. Is there's a lot of people listening to this, a lot of my podcast listeners, my audience, and I'd imagine a lot of people that, I mean, you, I've told you this before, I think, but your Twitter account is one of my absolute favorites. And whenever I want to know anything, I'm like, what does Steve think about this? you're like my like compass that I go to. But and I know that's the case for a lot of people. But the reason I bring that up is because I know a lot of people, have written off, like, you know, especially when elites, maybe like you or I in our past might have said, like for me, I would say, my first marathon, I ran so hard that I, the final few miles, I didn't know who I was. I couldn't see anything. I was bent over 90 degrees by the finish. And people were like, well, I don't do that. I can't be tough. when actually now I'm like, what exactly were you thinking? you said about it can be trained. It's not like a you have it or you don't. Did you see that? I'd love to see an example of you were a college coach for many years, cross country and track. And I know, that my husband, also named Steve, is, also a college coach. And I've seen him have athletes who have come in and been like really struggling at the beginning, kind of struggled, give in easily. But over time they've become that kind of, gritty little person. And so I'd love for you to give maybe a few examples to someone who is thinking, well, I'm not tough, but doesn't see how that could ever change.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the beauty of coaching, is you get to see these transformations, right? And I can think of, several examples. One example off the top of my head, as we had a female, walk-on distance runner who honestly didn't probably deserve to make the team based on her times, but it was early in my career and we had so few numbers. I was just like, everybody, like, welcome,
yeah,
show up, come on the team. And I'm so glad we did, because again, this athlete, like, not very good in high school, came in, like, didn't see themselves as like competitive, didn't see themselves as tough, like thought, looked up at everybody else and said, like, there's no chance. Like, and they kind of just went through the motions, right? Mm-hmm. When they're racing, and you can kind of tell, right? You can look at them and be like, oh, there's more there. But that's the beauty of coaching. It's your job when you see that and you say, oh, there's more there. Like, how do I get that out of somebody? And over time, like cultivating, training, like putting them in situations where they can succeed. Like you see that inner confidence start to grow. You see that competitive start to grow. And, you know, with this individual, went from, again, someone who shouldn't be on the team to, she finished third at our conference championship in the 5K, the second to last event, and clinched the team conference championship. And she was, again, a walk-on who wasn't supposed to do anything. Mm-hmm. And every coach has those stories. And I think we need to think of those as, this isn't the exception. This is the norm. Mm-hmm. If we give people the freedom to perform, they're able to do amazing things. But so much of society is, we're essentially holding people back. Mm-hmm. Because like you look around, whether it's, I love social media, but you look around at social media and it's like, all you get is signals that like, oh, you're not as good as this other person. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not as fast as this other person on Strava. Like, oh, I haven't trained as much or as many miles or volume or what have you. So society just kind of inundates us with these messages that we're not good enough or we're not as good or we're not capable or we're lower on the totem pole. Yeah. And it's our job to get that voice out of your head and be like, no, that's just fake. Like, you don't know how good you are. You don't know how good you can be until you like put yourself in those positions and give yourself a shot.
Yes. And also you mentioned a few minutes ago that even elite athletes who were, typically or had been in the past gritty, a fighter, able to have a lot of these ranking in the test or whatever you said the word you did was, when they were in a bad patch, that shows the, you know, everyone A goes through ups and downs, but also that it can be even people who are one of the best can still have that crash down of confidence and think, oh, well, maybe I'm not. So, yeah, it's good to hear that as well.
You know, one of the most enlightening things I think I ever did was I went around, this was a college and elite athletes, and just asked the question. I said, how many of you have ever thought about quitting in the middle of a race or like finding a hole to step in or like looking at that curb in the marathon and being like, you know, oh, like that would be nice to trip on and then I'd be out of it. And everybody raises their hands, right? You just did there. I do. I did all the time. Yeah. And that's, it's simple because that's what our brain is meant to protect us. Right? It's saying, you know what? This thing we're doing is really difficult and there's a lot of pain and discomfort and fatigue coming at us. Like, I'm going to send that alarm, that warning sign to tell you to try and get you to find an out or to slow down. And that's just because our brain has to be like that. If it didn't send the alarm until much later or ever, then we quite possibly could run ourselves to death, right?
Yeah.
So we want that alarm. But the reality is, like, I think it's comforting when you realize everybody has that. Everybody experiences that. Even the best of the best. It's not something that, like, we tend to hold up our highest performers and think that, like, oh, these people are, you know, they have minds of steel. They never have doubts or insecurities or what have you. They're superhuman. Mm-hmm. No, the reality is they're just like you or I. It's just, probably they've spent a very long time training and then getting used to things. And then whether deliberately or maybe subconsciously, like figuring out strategies for how to handle difficult things that often they can get through it.
Thank you to UCAN for sponsoring this episode of the Running for Real podcast and for making all my recent races really easy, really comfortable and steady on energy. Such an important piece of being able to run well. Now, today I want to tell you a bit more about UCAN Edge. Now, you've heard me mentioning Edge before, and I've also told you how I used to make my own gels because from UKEN powder, because I was so confident in the product. I've been using it since 2014 that I couldn't bear to try anything else. And so I made my own gels. I, you know, had them in my elite bottles, but I also carried them myself in other races. And I carried my own fuel in all of the races I've done since I left the elite world in 2017. But now I am really excited that UKEN has Edge out, which actually was given an award by Runner's World as in the 2022 Fitness Awards. Now, Edge is this convenient portable pouch that is going to give you that steady, nonstop energy. There's orange and strawberry banana flavor. Strawberry banana is really good. I love that. It's going to give you nonstop energy, and you're not going to have any sugar in there to give you highs and crashes. Now, it is something that is used by the professionals out in the world. It is going to be long lasting. It's going to give you just allow you to maintain your blood sugar level at a stable level. And it's good on digestion. There are no stomach upsets with this product. So, my friends, as a friend of the Running For Real podcast, you can get yourself 20% off by going to ucan.co and using code TINAUKAN. As I said, I've been using this in all my races. I will be using UKAN gels and bars exclusively, no other fueling for my upcoming 50K. And that is because I really trust the product. I think it works so well. And also, yeah, check out the bars on that note. Go to ucan.co and use code TINAUKAN to get yourself 20% off everything on the website. Yes, so true. We're going to dig into that in a little bit. But before we go to that, I want to stick on quitting for just a minute here. Now, this might be where it's a little bit different for many of the listeners who are recreational runners, who are coming at this from a different place to you and I, who very, you know, coming up high school, college, professional. I would love to hear a little bit of A, how you untangled your own relationship with quitting during the writing of this book and just understanding this. But B, yeah, why is it so hard? Like, why does quitting feel like such a failure? Like, I remember when I left the sport, it was very much like, God, I couldn't hack it. I just couldn't hack it. And that was, yeah, absolutely the worst feeling was quitting something. So yeah, talk about what it means, why it's so hard, and how you untangled that. Because I'm assuming you had a tough time with that reality as well. At least
yeah, it is. It is. Quitting is probably the most, it's just the most difficult thing because we associate it with failure, as you point. We associate it with like giving up. And I think that an association is unfair because often, like, if you step back, we quit at many things throughout our days, weeks, months, life, right? We quit by not choosing to do them. And that often frees us up to do other things that might better suit our talents or like motivations in the moment. So instead of seeing it as quitting, like seeing it as, am I making a wise choice? And what really drove home this for me is when I was talking to climbers who had tried to summit or did summit like Mount Everest or what have you, right? Major climbs like that. And I remember one telling me, said, Steve, quitting isn't weakness. It's the tough decision. If you choose to quit and are deliberate and intentional about it, that makes you tough. And I was like, what in the world do you mean by that? And he said, well, think about it like this. When I'm headed up the summit, and I can see that peak, that summit, that Mount Everest like top in the distance. And I'm like, oh, I'm only a couple hundred meters from reaching my goal. The easy thing in that moment is to push towards that summit because I spent months and years prepping to reach this goal. So of course I want to drive forward and withstand all the discomfort to get there. But the hard thing that I need to do is to step back and be like, hey, can I make it to the top? But more importantly, can I make it all the way back down to the bottom? Right? So in that moment, and this climber said that, like, I've been there before, turning around is often the wise choice. Because if I can't say, hey, I can make it to the top, I'm risking my life, which puts my family, my wife, my kids, whatever, at in a much worse spot. So I better make sure that if I'm making it, I'm going, I can make it all the way back down too. So sometimes quitting is the wise and tough choice. And I think that's how I kind of like had to navigate this as well. As you know, like during the pandemic, I made a decision to quote unquote quit and step away from college coaching. And that was super hard because here I was, I felt like I was letting down these, you know, 30 odd college kids who I'd spent the last couple of years getting to know and help to develop and all this stuff. And I knew it was going to be a tough conversation and all that stuff. And it was like, it was very difficult. And part of me throughout that time, it's like, oh, just this, like, don't do this, suck it up. Like, just keep coaching. Everything will be okay. But I knew if I did that, if I wasn't going forward with the motivation, drive, care, etc., that these kids deserved. Mm-hmm. And I had to have that self-awareness, just like the climber. Is this something that I want to do? Like, or not even want to do. Is this something that I have the time, space, and energy to do to my best ability and still satisfy these other needs of family, like friends, et cetera, that don't, you know, that aren't supplied by coaching? And navigating that, having that awareness to like untangle that was incredibly difficult. And it took a lot of time and thinking and all that good stuff. But it really started with, I had to let go a little bit and not see quitting as like abandoning or like failure or like I'm not good enough or I'm letting these people down. I had to reframe that and say, okay, is this a wise action given everything else that is going on in your life?
So good. Thank you so much for explaining that. I have to ask the question that I'm sure would have come up in people's minds as you were saying that, which is, okay, so how does that relate to when I'm in a race, like we were just talking about? And I remember many occasions where, like, I wonder if I limp for a minute, like clutching my hamstring, then I could just say that my, you know, like, yeah, that. So then how does that tie in? Because surely you're not. You know, you're there to do it. You're committed. Like, you're going to feel terrible after. How do you navigate the two almost like opposite ends of the spectrum here?
So I think this is where it comes down to is you have to be able to understand and almost distinguish what is real and what is fake. Mm. So when we get in that mindset of, oh, what happens if maybe I'll just grab my hamstring and then it'll give the appearance that like, oh, she's hurt and this gives me the leeway. Well, what is it? Is that real or kind of fake? You know what I mean? Like, am I, but it would be different if your hamstring actually grabbed and then you're like, oh, I could press on and maybe get through this, but am I putting myself at risk? You know, that hurts something that I like doing, running, for example, then you have every right to quit. Like, you probably should quit, you know, if you're causing that damage. So to me, it's about like wrestling with that nuance of like what you're feeling, the experience, all of those good things so that you can make that wise decision. Because sometimes it is to step away. Other times it's to be like, no, that's just like this crazy, you know, devil on my shoulder that's trying to protect me. But like, my hamstring isn't really hurt. Like, I'm not really in danger. Like, I'm just a little tired and fatigued and all that stuff and uncertain on if I can make it to the finish, but I'm really okay. So it's about distinguishing that reality versus like, that almost like fake delusion that's just trying to like convince you to do something.
Yes, that's so clear. Thank you for explaining that. One more question related to that. then when you do make the right choice, when you did step away from college coaching, or when I did step away from running, or you did step off the course with your hamstring that had grabbed, while there's a sense of relief of like, okay, it's done, it still feels pretty terrible. So let's just talk through that for a minute.
It does. And that's normal. And because it's part of who you are, right? It's your identity is wrapped up into the things. You know, when you stepped away from running for so long, your identity is, well, I'm a runner. Mm. This is who I am. This is what people know I am. This is where I get my like validation and competency and all these things. Same thing in coaching, right? People know me as a coach, like blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. It's normal to feel like that. And here I would turn to, it's no different than people who experience grief, for example. You know, it's almost like a part of you when you quit is kind of lost. And I think there's a couple different things as we unpack this. If you look at people who go through grief, right, the death of a loved one, of a child, of, you know, loss of some sort, what ends up happening is they either can navigate it or it tends to spiral and they experience what's called complicated grief. And complicated grief is essentially when you get stuck. You get stuck on the loss, the experience, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think those who navigate it well, what research has shown is that A, they accept the situation. They accept the loss. They accept that it's something real. They embrace the like grief, the emotions, the experience. They don't try and push it away or avoid it. And then finally, they try and make meaning out of it. And I think that's the probably most important point is like, it's like integrating it into your story. It's not, oh, I was a runner or I was a coach. It was that running and coaching is part of who I am. At one point, it played a much larger part of who I am. But the good thing is, you know, we're all many yous. We all have many roles. And if one kind of goes away or goes into maintenance mode, that just frees you up to experience this other stuff. So in your life, I'm sure like the running went down, but that opened up space for you to succeed and take on other challenges and kind of define yourself in different ways. Mm. And I think this is what it's about. And I think this is also why, you know, this is somewhat related. We often think, you know, the toughest, the best performers are all in on one thing. But the reality is they're able to diversify their sense of self. So if this thing goes badly, there's still something else. And Sarah Hall is one who taught me this really well. Mm. Is she really has taken off in her career. And I think almost by kind of letting go to a degree, because Sarah has like all these other things in her life. And yes, running is super important, but her husband, her children, her family, all these other, her religion, all these other things that like also hold a place that are near and dear to her heart. So that if she has a tough race, yeah, she's going to be super bummed, but there's always something else to fill that hole, that fill that gap. It's not, oh, I had a tough race. I am myself. I'm a failure as a person. It's, oh, I just struggled in this race. How can I move forward? And I think that space between who you are and what you do is so important to be able to navigate life successfully.
So Sarah is obviously a good example of that, but we don't typically see too much of that. I mean, maybe that is the problem with social media, that it very much like the selective, you know, looking through a window of what we see, but it very much comes across a lot of the time as like, wow, look how committed that person is. They were training this morning, now they're in the gym, now they're having a massage, now they're doing this, now they're making themselves a meal with 27 ingredients. You know, it doesn't come across that way. So you've had a real insight into the elite world, not only yourself, but as a coach. Just, yeah, remind listeners that a little bit more, because it can feel very much the opposite with a few exceptions.
Yeah. So first off, Instagram isn't reality.
Really?
That's number one. And I think that does us a big disservice. But if you look at it, all of these elite athletes are very driven, right? And of course, they're going to work extremely hard. We're not saying that. But the same thing that makes them really good can also be the thing that gets in their way. And you see this with many examples. There's so much dedication that it gets in the way, and it almost becomes this obsession that they have to do instead of they want to do. Mm-hmm. And whenever you make that move to have to instead of want to, bad things happen. That's generally where you see athletes start to struggle, start to underperform, et cetera, et cetera. So the ones that I've seen succeed over the long haul, like a Sarah Hall, are the ones who have some sort of, you know, perspective and diversifying their meaning and interests. Another example I'll give you is an athlete, actually, I still coach, Roberta Groner, who, you know, in her 40s got sixth at the world championships in the marathon. And she was, at the time, and still is, a full-time nurse with children, you know? And, you know, I remember having this conversation. It's like, well, do you think you'd be better if you were a full-time runner? And she'd be like, no, I'd drive myself nuts.
Yeah.
You know, and here's someone who's reached, you know, the upper echelons of the sport. And I think it has that perspective, and you're seeing more and more of that. You're seeing, like, people like Kira D'Amato, who has, like, you know, a family and children and works as a realtor. You know, Sarah Vaughn, family, children, works as a realtor. Like, you're seeing people not, I'm not saying that, like, hey, you have to have, like, all of these things, but I think it's important to have other items. You know, actually, it comes to mind, I was talking to, like, a very well-known sports psychologist who told me years ago, he said, you know, I was talking to one of the, who at the time was one of the best American, you know, distance runners, and they were in a struggle, and, you know, they spent hours talking, working together, and he just ends and he says, you know what? You need a hobby. That's what's holding you back. And she's like, a hobby? What are you talking about? She's like, you need something else that you enjoy doing. Yeah. And she thought he was crazy, but he was like, you know what? The next year, she made the final at the Olympics, and that was her goal. And she did it. And she came back and she said, look at all these things that, like, I knitted, because knitting became her hobby. And it seems like so ludicrous, but I love that story, because it's like, we all need other things, like other things that give us, like, some sort of meaning or purpose or hobby to take our mind off of just this soul thing that, like, often, you know, takes over our world, which in our case is often related to running.
Yeah, so true. Thank you for explaining that. And I hope that's given listeners an opportunity to rethink just the way you're approaching your training as you move forward. I want to talk about expectations and reality when we are in or preparing to do and then going through either a performance or a workout or whatever it may be. Now, I'm a big proponent of wearing a watch, not looking at a watch. Like, everything I did was always effort, didn't know my paces. I thrived on that. So I've always been trying to convince people, if you don't know, you're not going through what you ended up describing here of, like, if you end up going too fast, or what you think is too fast, you're like, I can't do this. This is too fast. So I'm going to blow up. Or if it's slow, oh, what is wrong with me? Why am I slow? I'd love to talk about that here. How, when we have, or let's take the last workout before a race always goes terrible, right? Because we're like, oh, it's only this, or I've only got to run that. And we think it's going to be easy, and then it doesn't. It's still hard running, or some version of that. Talk about what you learned through that, and yeah, what you want to get across to people, because that gets us in trouble a lot.
Oh, yes. Our expectations are kind of our biggest foe in a lot of ways. And I love the example you gave there, which is the last workout before any race often feels absolutely horrible. And then we start freaking out because we're like, oh my gosh, this wasn't supposed to be that difficult. And it felt really difficult. Like, and you spiral. Well, why did that happen? Because you're tapering down. You look at the workout and you say, oh, this isn't as hard as normal. This is going to be a piece of cake, but it's still a workout. You still have to, like, it's still somewhat hard. So this is a great example of when you're, when there's a mismatch between your expectations and reality, that gives your brain the space to freak out, right? Because your brain says, hey, I was expecting this and I got this, whether that's easier or harder, like sound the alarm, hit the panic button. Mm-hmm. And all we're trying to do is make sure that our brain doesn't hit that panic button so that it doesn't send us spiraling, or it hits the panic button when it's supposed to, or in a way that we can control it. So the thing that I try and tell runners is that, or anybody really, and I try and convey in the book, is that it's not about, often we think like toughness is about, oh, I'm going to go in and like have this like fierce confidence and this overwhelming optimism and just picture everything going right and all that good stuff. Well, what are you doing? You're creating unrealistic expectation. Like, even during your best marathon, it's going to feel like crap sometimes, right? It always does. If you go in expecting that it feels easy, well, guess what? You're going to freak out. So then sometimes runners will come to me and they'll be like, oh, okay, then I'm just going to expect it to be really hard. Well, what have you done? You've shifted the other way. Because if you expect it to be incredibly difficult, your brain's going to be like, oh, this is going to be the hardest marathon in our life. So like, keep the reins on, like, don't push, don't even come close to that line. So to me, it's pretty simple, is set appropriate expectations. And then to your point is understand if whatever feedback you're taking in, be it the watch or anything, is that helping or hurting? And for a lot of people, the watch hurts. You know, I was talking to an athlete that I work with who just ran the Boston Marathon, who like loved, was obsessed with the pace, like, I'm going to do this, you know, pace. And like, when she finally had a very good race at Boston, she was like, you know what, Steve, for the last, it was like the last 18 miles of the race, I didn't look at my watch once. So during the first, whatever, couple, 6-8 miles, yeah, she looked at it some, but then she realized, this is getting in my way. Like, I'm turning this thing, like, forget this thing. I'm just going by feel. And that freed her up to perform. So know if your watch is getting in the way or aiding you. And then,
does it help some people? You are like the perfect person for me to ask this to. Do you think some people do need that?
I think some people can use it at the right time. Mm-hmm. So what I mean by that is you have a certain subsection of people, for instance, in the marathon, who no matter what you tell them will go out all gung-ho mm-hmm. the first couple miles and put themselves in a hole. For people like that, the watch can do a good job of holding them back.
Okay.
For other people, not so much. So as a coach, it kind of comes down to the individuality of it. The way I kind of look at it is I use the watch as a tool to hold people back, and then I free them up if that's the case. So for example, it's like, all right, you're worried about going out too fast. I'm a little concerned based on your history. So guess what? The first, I don't know, 10K, look at your watch. After that, like, throw it away if you want. Like, I don't want you to watch it. That's just to keep, it's like a limiting factor. But I'm like you, I kind of hate and despise watches. So, and it's pretty simple. If you're listening to this podcast and you're like, well, how do I know? Well, just pay attention. Are you looking down at your watch during a race and a hard workout? And how does that make you feel? Do you look down and are you like, have that tinge of anxiety and you're like, oh my gosh, am I slow or fast? Well, you should throw your watch away.
Thank you. Thank you to Allbirds for sponsoring this episode of the Running for Real podcast and for just making me feel so appreciated and loved and looking after our community too. Allbirds is really trying to change the game. They believe that your carbon footprint for each product that is made or purchased should be as visible as price. They believe that is just as critical of a piece of information that we should know. And that is why Allbirds has the carbon emissions number on every single item they have. It's clear. It shows you, you know, how they're working on things. You see the numbers changing over time, particularly when it comes to the shoes. Their shoes are far lower emissions than any other shoes on the market, and they are continuing to drive those numbers down. And they also have a great range of items for you to go check out, be it if you want running clothes or lifestyle clothes. And I'm actually surprised how many Allbirds items I see around. I have lots of different types of shoes from them, but I want to tell you about a few of the options today. So there's the running shoes. There is another pair of running shoes. I cannot tell you about it just yet, but there is a pair coming out this month, which is the pair I wore in Boston. I wore in Maui. I've been wearing for my workouts, but I will tell you more about that when I'm allowed to. However, for now, you can go check out the Tree Dashers 2, which can handle a regular run, but they are not really designed. They're kind of designed for every day plus a run. So if you're going on a short trip, you can easily add them in. I also have a lot of the other casual pairs of shoes that I wear every day. They are incredibly comfortable, and they don't wear through very often. That's one thing I've really enjoyed about them, is that they're not, you don't see them, you don't poke a hole in the top, or you don't wear down the bottom. They really are made to last, and they're made of materials that are good for the planet, like wool. And the midsole is made of sugarcane, by the way. So they have these proprietary materials that they use to really use plant-based materials like castor bean oil that emits less carbon than petroleum foam, all kinds of things, recycled laces. There's a lot that goes into this. So you can go to allbirds.com to go check out more and let them know I sent you. Well, and if you are constantly using your watch, you're never going to learn what that feels like, because you're just continuing this cycle and actually making it more ingrained in you. I do spend a lot of time trying to show the same thing to people, and I just want to speak to something that people always rebuttal me with, which is, but when I don't look, then I feel anxiety. And you will at first, right? Or at least in my experience, when I'm speaking to people, there will be that, like, I want to look, I want to look, I want to look, don't look, I want to look. But that fades over time and you get better at understanding your pace and you feel better. So then you don't need it as much, and that voice quietens down. At least that's been my experience. Anything to add there?
Yeah, that is, if you constantly feel the need to look, then what I would say is that's like an addiction. And it's no different than, well, if I have my phone sitting next to me during this podcast or while writing, yeah, I constantly want to look at that too. But is that a good thing? Probably not. So I'm with you 100%. If you feel that need to look, you gotta sit with that until it goes away, or do some runs where you realize that you're fine and you're okay when you leave your watch at home. So separating the kind of addictive quality versus the, is this giving me good information that I'm using appropriately?
Yes. Thank you so much. Okay, let's talk a little bit about goals. Now, you had, again, in this, a different take on what we're kind of told in society with. We're told shoot for the stars, you reach land among the moon, that kind of stuff. Or people have a very, well, I'm not going to set goals because I'll just either disappoint myself or I get addicted to them. Talk about your opinion on setting goals.
Yeah, so I'm a big believer in goals should reflect reality. And what often happens is we get told, you know, set a big goal, you know, shoot for the moon, as you said, all that stuff. Well, what happens is if you don't come close or you don't reach that over time, it almost becomes a roadblock. And I experienced this myself, right? I was one of those runners who kind of like put the times they wanted to run up on their wall or in their, you know, bathroom mirror or what have you. And at first it's really motivating, but if you don't hit those for a while, then it becomes this like constant reminder that, oh, you're not good enough. Oh, you're not hitting your stuff. So in that case, the goal has shifted from something that motivates to something that reminds you that like things aren't going well. And if that's the case, then your goal is no longer working with you. So I'm a bigger fan of setting appropriate goals, right? That are just like we talked about. And then I think the other thing that is really important is authentic goals. Okay, if you look at a long line of research, both in athletics and then workplace and school, is that we often have our goals imposed on us. A coach, a teacher, a parent, a boss tells us what we think we should shoot for. And whenever goals are imposed upon us, they don't work. They just backfire. And then the other thing I'd say is for goals as well, that again, research and practice shows us is really important, is don't just think of the peak, the ceiling, the highest point, as we often do with our goal. Make your goal to be like consistent, to raise the floor. I had a really good athlete who then went into the military, who always told me, is like, Steve, you know, if I can show up to a race and almost no matter what, run, you know, compete in this way, run X time, then I know when the stars align and it's my day, my peak is going to be even higher. So my goal is to raise that floor where I can show up no matter what and still give this effort. And I think there's something so powerful in that, because so often we're told, you know, you're almost defined by your best performance ever, but those best performances come so few and far between that it's like a really poor tactic to put so much emphasis and focus on that. And it'll inevitably turn into something that kind of holds us back.
Yes. You talked about the lowering the bar, raising the floor. And another way you said that was improving your best average, which I thought really that makes so much sense. As you just mentioned, those amazing stars aligned days don't happen that often. And it's such a good way of reminding us of that to improve where you are on when you look at it as a whole. Now, when it comes to setting goals, within the running community, again, I've always had kind of a bit of like back and forth with people saying, you know, they're 12 weeks out. I want to know what my goal is. Like, I need to set a goal. And I've always been hesitant to encourage people to do that because, as you said, let it unfold for you. When do you typically tell people to start to set a goal during a training cycle?
Yeah, so I actually tell people to set your goal and then kind of forget about it. Mm-hmm. Because I think, yes, it's good to have something to focus on. But if it steals too much of our power, then we're set back. And I'll actually use a great example from Sarah Hall again. If you look at her recent, where she set the American record in the half marathon, you know, I believe she tweeted about this, but she said, you know, as she was getting into the race, she realized that the time goal was getting in the way and she let go of it in the weeks and months leading up to the race. She set a goal to set the American record months out, but then she realized it was like stealing her joy. So she let go and she said, you know what? My new goal is I just want to get in there with the top Americans, feel a certain way and compete a certain way. And I think there's so much self-awareness in that as well, is that you have to realize when the goal is helping you and motivating you, and then when it's stealing your joy. And as a coach, I think it's like, yeah, I'm fine. If you want to set a goal 12 weeks out, 10 weeks out, 8 weeks out, that's fine. But it can't be, this is the goal. This is all that matters. Like, this is unchangeable. We have to have the flexibility to do that. And if you can't, if you don't possess that ability to like let go, then I'm not going to set that goal in the first place because I know it's going to get in the way eventually.
Is there ever a time not to set goals and just to, or do you think that's, you have to be in a certain mindset to handle that?
You know, I'm just going to go all nuance on you. Of course I do. You know, people are going to come away from this podcast and be like, what should I do? Should I do this? Should I not? But that's the point. is like the nuance is what it's about. I'll give you a great example. I'll give you an example from my own life. For so long, I had running under a 4 minute mile as a goal because I was close for so long. My PR was 4:01. Like, this should happen, blah, blah, blah. Well, after like banging my head against the wall for so long, I realized that like this was taking away from all experiences I had of racing. And it didn't have to be a mile. I just started hating racing because everything was so goal oriented. So for a while there, in the tail end of I was, you know, running relatively competitively, I was just like, I have no goals. I don't want to have any goals. My goal is to show up, feel good, and like feel like I can compete. And in my early to mid 30s, I got in, you know, probably the best shape of my life again by not having goals, by not trying to do anything crazy, but by just enjoying the process of it. And it brought back like the joy of competing, even though I didn't even race that much. I would jump in workouts and a couple of like time trials with my college team. And that was super fun. And I'm so glad I had that experience so that I wasn't left with this taste of like, oh, shooting for these goals that are never attainable is driving me nuts. So I think, yes, absolutely.
Like, yes.
For certain people, let go of it. Like if you find yourself not enjoying competing, one last example is when helping Natasha Rogers come back from a multi-year layoff. At the very beginning, we didn't set any goals, you know, for months and months. And actually her first season was like, there are no goals. We're just going after a feeling. We're just going after, are you enjoying running again? Was that a good workout? And you know what? She got down to low 15 minutes in the 5K, I think 15:08, based on no goals and instead just chasing like, hey, is this fun? And literally, sometimes we'd have conversations where it would be like, she'd be like, ah, I don't know about this. I'm kind of feeling a little burnt. And I'd be like, well, you know, take some time off in the middle of the season. Or we'd be like, what's energizing? You know, she'd be like, oh, I really want to do this half marathon. Well, in my head, I'm like, I'm training you for track 5K, but sure. Like, if you really want to do this half marathon, jump in it. Like, if that's what makes you excited, yeah, go for it. So sometimes you've got to like put that by the wayside and just let things happen.
And well done to you for being able to do that. And there was multiple examples in the book of you doing stuff like that, like you talked about the girl with throwing up before races. So well done to you for being able to, and I'll let listeners read about that, for being able to like, yeah, go against what your head is saying as well. Now, one other concept I just want to cover is control. Because runners have absolutely no problem with control. So there's nothing to talk about here, right? We are not control freaks or anything like that. No. When I was reading the beginning of that section, what kept coming to mind to me is weather. In the days before a race, runners obsess about weather. You know, what's it going to do? Checking it hourly, or it says it's going to be this, it's going to be that. Can you just talk to that a little bit more in terms of if someone is someone who struggles with trying to control things they have no control over, what should be a step they should take other than reading the book?
Yeah, read the book. That's number one. That'll cure all runners' worries about weather. If I did that, I'd sell a million copies. So I think it's important. So this is, again, nuance. When we feel like we have a sense of control, we perform better. When we feel like we are at loss and we have no control over what we can do, the outcomes, anything like that, we tend to not perform well. Our persistence goes down. Our enjoyment of it goes down. So what does that mean? It means that we should have some sense of control over our effort towards something. Now, when we get to things like weather, that's entirely out of our control. We can't influence that. So what happens is that creates this big uncertainty and this big stress, because here's this thing that we've deemed that matters a lot. We can't influence it. We don't have control over it. So it triggers this uncertainty stress response that causes us to like fixate, ruminate, catastrophize on this like one variable. So when I talk to runners about this, is you have to learn how to let go of things that are outside of your control and really grasp onto and hold on to things that are within it. And the beauty of this is it can be very small things. You know, there's all sorts of research that shows that even things like our pre-performance, pre-race ritual, the reason we do those things isn't because we actually think that, hey, if I tie my shoes a certain way and like warm up in this manner, that that's going to influence the race and make us perform better. We do those things because it's human nature, because when we're facing something that is kind of uncertain, we do rituals to give us this feeling of control. It's why baseball players, when they walk up to bat, have all these elaborate, you know, pre-bat like rituals where they touch their gloves a certain way and all this stuff. It's human nature. It gives us some sense of control. Now, the good thing about that is what? It tells us that even the smallest of items can make us feel like we have a little bit of control over a situation that is uncertain. So in your own life, it's what's my pre-race routine? What are things that I can control over? What are things that I can focus on and actually get done that make me feel like, oh, this is part of the race. This is part of what I can do and get better.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for that. Although just to follow on the rituals, is that ever a bad thing with
100%.
You're going to say, yeah, again.
100%. So this is, you know, this is, again, maybe my poor salesmanship, but everything works and it doesn't. Uh-huh. Right? So rituals are great unless, again, you become so dependent on it that now you think that, oh, if I don't do this, I'm not going to be able to perform at my best. Mm-hmm. So what do I tell athletes when they have rituals? I say, well, first off, you want your ritual to be something that you can always do.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's got to be something that no matter what you can always do. And B is be aware if it's getting in the way or helping. And if it's getting in the way, then you need to switch to another way that you can feel like, hey, I have some sense of control over the situation, that, hey, I'm in charge and can influence my performance and my outcome.
Mm, yes, exactly. And the reason I ask that is because one of my rituals used to be to listen to these three songs in order before. This is my college season, which was fine most of the time. People always laugh because one of them was Remember the Name by Fort Minor, which doesn't really match to my personality. But it was one that I'm sure many others have chosen. Anyway, when I took that to the road racing scene and I had to drop off my phone and my bag with hours before, then what was I supposed to do? Like I couldn't have, and then it really started to mess with me for a while. So that's why I wanted to ask that, because as you said, it's got to be able to work for every situation. Okay. Final thing I want to ask you about, related to control again, you said about the importance of giving yourself a choice. It's okay to say I'll miss a day or two if I have to. This is another component that runners really struggle with, particularly if you say, I really want to commit to this goal and give all I have. Just talk to that a little bit about, yeah, listening to your body in that way.
So if you look at the science, toughness, resilience is trained when you have a choice. It's not trained when you feel like you have to do something. And that could be an internal sensation of I have to, or it could be external of like, I'm going to get punished unless I do that. In those situations, we're not training our mental muscle. Because if you look at the neuroscience behind it, essentially what you're doing is you're trying to ingrain in your head the path towards, hey, I can make the choice to like do the hard thing, to go down the difficult path, to not default towards the protect, freak out, et cetera path. And the way you do that is simple. You have to have that choice. You have to have that experience. So when I look at runners again, I think of it as, can you take that day off when it is the wise action to take? if you can, great. You're training resilience because everything in your mind is often pulling you to do the other thing of like, oh, I have to be compulsive and get out the door and run. And if I don't, my running streak ends and I'll feel unproductive. That's all going back to the very beginning of our conversation. That's all fake, right? We know that one day off every once in a while doesn't sabotage months worth of training. In fact, it can help and benefit. If you're taking the day off because it helps support your training, it helps support your adaptation, it helps support your recovery, that should be the good thing. And if everything in your mind is pulling you not to do that, that gives you that signal that, hey, this is like a compulsion. This isn't like something that is like making me strong, tough, or confident. This is something that I need to learn how to like navigate. It's almost like it takes more courage to take a day off than to continue to beat your head against the wall, because that is like what you've done for years and years.
Sure. It's funny. That's why when people ask me about like, do you want to do a run streak? I'm like, absolutely not. Like, I spent so many years like struggling to take those days off that like, I know how this, at least for me, I know how this plays out. Like, I'm not going down that road. I mean, for people that do, that's amazing that it keeps them, you know, towards something meaningful. But yeah,
it's great. And it serves a great purpose. But the way that I like to think of it is, are you in charge or is the thing? In this case, the thing is the run streak or the like having to run every day. If you're choosing to do that, great. Keep doing it. Like if it brings joy and whatever to your life and et cetera, great. Keep choosing it. But if all of a sudden, again, it's making that transition to you're not choosing, you're not in control, but the thing is almost like beckoning you, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. it's almost like that addictive quality, then that's when you need to be able to step back and be like, hey, I've got to create some distance because like I'm no longer in charge and that's not a good thing.
Yes. Okay, Steve, to round up here, as I said, this was a half to two thirds of my questions. And so for listeners, I mean, this is, I can't wait to finish this. And I'm sure there's so many more questions you have. Be excited to dig into here. But Steve, to leave the listeners, what would you like to remind people? What would you like to be your final parting message about toughness and resilience, especially as we've covered, a lot of our world isn't set up to align with what we've talked about today?
Yeah. You know, I think one of the more important, a lot of what we've talked about is like on an individual level, but what is really intriguing to me is it's also true on a like group, team, organizational level, which is often we think that like toughness is trained or developed as a team through like discipline and power and control. But if you look at, again, the research and the best athletic teams, some of which I talk to in professional sports, it's actually the opposite, which is when you show people you care, when you show people they're valued, when like people feel secure in their environment, when people feel like they belong, they're way tougher than any sort of like hard, you know, power control, authoritarian, dictatorship, disciplinarian style approach that we often see in sport. So the takeaway to me is like, if you want people to perform over the long haul and have all these great qualities that come with grit, resilience, and toughness, treat them like decent human beings and allow them to flourish. And if you do so, good things will happen.
Yes. Thank you so much. What a good way to end. Do hard things, why we get resilience wrong, and the surprising science of real toughness. When this comes out, it will not be available yet, but you can go get it on pre-order. There will be links in the show notes. Steve, I've mentioned your Twitter account is one of my absolute favorites. Anywhere else they can go find you?
Yeah, they can check me out at stevemagnus.com or sign up to my newsletter at The Growth Equation.
Great. Thank you so much. I appreciate you. And I'm sure the listeners did too.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Hi, friends. Just a quick message to say a big thank you to the Running For Real team. While I may be the face of Running For Real and the voice behind the podcast, there are a group of people who are working tirelessly to provide everything that runners could need within our community, to make our community stronger, better, and evolve and grow and learn from one another. We are working really hard to make Running For Real the place we believe it can be within our community. I just want to take a moment to thank everyone on our team. That is Victoria, Stacy, Sandy, Sally, Maria, Kelsey, Kat, Jeremy, and Erica. I appreciate each and every one of you and the hard work that you put in. Now let's get back to the show. Well, what do you think? I hope that was enlightening for you, helpful for you. Yes, there was a lot of yes and no answers, but he did it in a very clear way that allowed, hopefully, at least me, hopefully allowed you to be able to see which of those situations fit for you and how to make it work within your own life. The book itself is fantastic, if in case I didn't make that already clear. So you can definitely go order yourself or pre-order yourself a copy, or make sure you can go get it at your local independent bookstore when it does come out. But I definitely recommend this book. I want to take a moment to thank our sponsors, Inside Tracker. You can get 20% off by going to insidetracker.com/Tina. You can also get 20% off at UCAN, that's UCAN.co, and you can use code TINAUCAN to get yourself 20% off the edge gels or the powder or the bars, whatever feels right for what you're doing. And thank you also to Allbirds. You can go to allbirds.com to check out what they are up to. Now, my friends, we have another running reunion episode on Wednesday. These are these 15 to 20 minute episodes, catch up episodes with previous guests, just to be more of a short, snappy, uplifting episode that you can maybe listen to while you're getting ready in the morning, just to remind you that things do come together and we're all on this roller coaster journey together. And also Together Runs do come out every Monday. So I hope you will check those out if you haven't not already. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you next week.